I sketched yesterday the outline of the various dynasties that covered about 2,000 years of the Chinese history. I'm not going to go into any detail on these. It was more a purpose just to show you how long China has been under emperors, and that we have a continuous state in China, more so than any other country in the world. There is no other nation on the face of the earth that has had 2,000 years of continuous history. Even the great empires of Europe, for instance, the Roman Empire, didn't last more than 400 or 500 years. And our modern empires haven't lasted more than a generation, with few exceptions. Not long ago, I, just for the fun of it, sat down and made a list of the empires that had fallen in my own lifetime. And it's a very long list when you start at the beginning of the century. There was the British Empire, which in Britain people thought would last forever. There was the German Empire in the days of Bismarck, which didn't last more than half a century. The French Empire, which included some of Africa and some of Southeast Asia, has gone. The Italian Empire, which extended across the Mediterranean into Libya and Tripoli, that's gone. You have and the old Russian Empire, with the czars that has stood for a very long time. So practically all the empires that we have known have undergone in our own lifetime a revolution and come to an end. Americans sometimes talk as if America is going to stand forever. And we're going to celebrate in a couple of years the 200th anniversary of America, which is not a very long time in the history of nations. But who is going to say how long the United States will last? 100 years ago, we were torn by a civil war, and it looked for a while as if we might divide into two states or two nations. And what's happened the last few years shows us that the unity of the American Empire is something that's very insubstantial. So as you look at these old empires of the world, it should make us a little more modest in our thoughts about our own great empires, if we're going to stand forever, and that whatever we do, we'll crush all our enemies and we'll be number one. That's a form of patriotism that I think hasn't much to do with Christianity. And I don't find anything in Christianity that supports us in that kind of arrogance or pride. It humbles us to think of what might happen in the light of what has happened to all other nations. Well, in China you do have these couple thousand years of history, and one could stop with any one of the dynasties and pick out some very interesting things. I'm anxious to get on to more modern times, and we'll do so. But there's one dynasty, or a couple of dynasties I'd like to just mention. The Sung dynasty, which we referred to, which included a couple of the world's most romantic and spectacular emperors. Back in the 13th century, the Mongolian emperors came into China, and the name of Genghis Khan, Kublai Khan, are found among the rulers of China. I don't know what these names mean to you, but if you know much about the history of Europe, you know there was a time when the name of Genghis Khan was something like Russian communism today. Everybody feared it. Genghis Khan was a great horsemen who gathered a tremendous cavalry of Chinese soldiers, and they swept over all of the China westward and way over the mountains of Tibet, over towards what is the southern part of Russia, as far as the Caspian Sea, and even farther into the eastern part of Europe. Everybody feared the barbarians. We have inherited a sort of a scare word from our own World War I, the Huns. It was a name given, of course, to the German armies. But long before, the Huns were a name given to Eastern barbarians who were coming. No one knew from where, but they were scaring all of Europe. And Genghis Khan was a word that conjured up all kinds of fears and trembling from the people of Europe. But in Russia, in China itself, Genghis Khan and Kublai Khan set up one of the most splendid courts of Eastern or Oriental history. And we have in European literature a echo of this in the journals of Marco Polo. I mentioned these journals the other day. This young Italian who went with his uncle on an expedition, trading expedition up into southern Russia, and then kept on going east until they came to Peking, to the great court of Kublai Khan. And they described for us, he and his uncle, what the magnificence of the temples and palaces and the armies and might of China was way back in the 13th century. Marco Polo was used by the emperor as a sort of a translator, but also to tell some of the things that were being done in the West, so that the Chinese got to find out something about the European life. But he finally came back to Italy and got mixed up in Italian politics, and spent a good part of his life later in jail in Genoa. And he wrote his journal, or the story of his trip in China. And the story of Marco Polo's visit to the court of Kublai Khan became a sort of a fairy story, tale of romance for hundreds of years throughout Europe. It wasn't a lot that the Europeans knew about China, and that any adventurer or traveler who came back and told about this wonderful country out in the Far East would, of course, receive a lot of attention, and Marco Polo's journals became one of the classics of the European literature. Well, Kublai Khan and Genghis Khan were a sort of a spectacular fireworks in the sky that sped through over the horizon and disappeared. But the Mongols, and these were Mongolians, took over the Chinese Empire. We have one of the dynasties that's called the Mongolian dynasty. It didn't last more than about a century, and was followed by the Ming dynasty. You'll find the word Ming dynasty referred to quite often in the history of painting and the history of art, because in this period, the art of China developed in a very marked way. Chinese made a great deal of writing, handwriting, and calligraphy, which is the art of handwriting. It became an art to them. And we're getting into that period in Chinese history where the calligraphy is itself one of the outstanding examples of the art. If you've ever been to a Chinese laundry, you've gotten sample of it in the writing of the Chinese. You can't make any sense out of it at all, I suppose. It sort of strokes that to the Chinese are what letters are to the alphabet. And the fine art of writing to the Chinese was something that they spent years and years in perfecting. And the calligraphy of the Chinese is a marvel. It still has a lot of interest for us today. I noticed just yesterday in the paper an account of the recent Congress of the Communist Party in China. And there's a new list of the rulers, the top men in the communist hierarchy. And they don't list them. We in the West are always wondering who are the names that are going to appear in these party congresses. It gives us a clue as to who is in power in China. Well, this new list of the 10 leading people in China today are listed. You can't list them in alphabetical order. The Chinese don't have our alphabet. And I was surprised to find that they are listed according to the number of strokes that it takes of the pen to write their name. And the top man has only 4 strokes. He's not a top man. I think Mao himself came down the list 4th or 5th. But the top man was a man, we would say, whose name was the shortest. But these strokes that you have in the Chinese alphabet, every one of them tells a story. So that the more intricate and complex this pictograph these lines are, the more it means. To a Westerner, the Chinese language seems almost insoluble. And I've been told that even missionaries who've spent years and years in China find it very difficult to speak so as to be understood or to write by the Chinese. We learn, I suppose, sort of the pidgin Chinese as they learn pidgin English. But the scholars or the writers have developed this art of writing so that every pen stroke says something. When one reads the kind of penmanship we have today, we can see how far we are at the other extreme, where we can hardly read each other's writing from where the typewriter has destroyed our penmanship. Though some of us may remember that early in school we used to have writing lessons where we copied and were able to write a decent letter. Well, the Chinese alphabet is very different. And this development of the calligraphy, the art of writing, is one of the aspects of the Chinese painting. In this Sung Dynasty, there's a very great emphasis upon painting. And I mentioned yesterday the philosophies of Confucius and Buddha. There was a third philosophy, Taoism, which was a sort of a popular religion. But it was also a very materialistic thing. Its emphasis was on things. And it represents even today in China the popular superstition of the village. Ideas about what's good luck and bad luck, and what the gods will do and won't do. All of it on a rather low level, but it has to do with a person's own success and prosperity. And it does emphasize a material environment. And in Chinese painting at this period, you have landscapes that are outstanding. If you've paid much attention to Chinese art, you'll know how beautiful the landscape paintings are. We are today in our art history going back to China to find something of the abstract quality, not kind of abstraction we know probably in Europe, but where you have the mountains and the rivers and the woods, not pictured as a photograph, but where there is a movement and a beauty in the proportion detail which makes this something very different. Chinese, American, and Japanese art are very different from European art. Well, far back here, 1,000 years ago, China was developing in these areas, and in the area of architecture, where they were building temples and sculptures, especially the statues of Buddha. There were inventions we take for granted, but that do come out of China long ago. The compass, for instance, was invented in China. Compass that enabled them to find their way through the vast stretches of China, though not much used until, that is, on the ocean until men began to travel more than they did on ocean. But the compass is a Chinese invention. Even the paper that is used in the printing is Chinese. We used to be told that it was invented in Egypt, papyrus. But long before we find the Egyptian paper, there is a bamboo production in China, which gradually evolved into paper. And the printing that was accomplished by these wooden blocks on which the letters would be printed and then impressed. China invented too the abacus, the counting machine. There's so much of this that has come into our practice now, but we've forgotten where it came from. But I suppose it would still be true that one of the outstanding achievements would be the development in porcelain. This beautiful fired pottery which could be painted and glazed and then becomes shaped into all kinds of great vases and smaller objects. That's a chapter that an artist should speak to us about, but it is something that was known to the Chinese way back in the Song Dynasty and even before, which is 1,000 years ago. It's with the Ming Dynasty, 1368 to 1344, that we begin to come into a new period in Chinese history. China, we said, called itself the Middle Kingdom, the Central Kingdom, the center of the world, for this was to the Chinese the world, and anything else was simply on the borders of China. And except for these contacts that they had through warfare, when they went north or west or south, the Chinese didn't know too much about the rest of the world, nor did they want to. Why should they, when they were the most accomplished and the most civilized of peoples? We said everyone else was barbarian to them, so there was no thought of going outside, except in the field of religion, where there was constant contact down toward the southwest with Burma and India. But in the 17th century, something happened that changes the whole outlook of China and determines to some extent the character of China even into our own day. And that was when the Western navigators began to penetrate the world. We read a lot in our own storybook, history books, of how the Portuguese and the Spanish and the Dutch and the English began to go across. Well, they'd go around Africa and come back into the Indian Ocean. Then they went across the Atlantic, Columbus, and all of the explorers to North and South America, and then around the Cape Magellan into the Pacific, and finally came over to the Philippines. And when you're getting towards the Philippines, you're getting awful close to China. And the Portuguese coming from the Indian Ocean, the Spanish coming from the Pacific, finally found China. Columbus thought he was on his way to India, but no one knew exactly what China was until in the 17th century these sailors began to show up around the edges of China. Among the first were the Portuguese, and they came down here to a place called Macau, which is right near Hong Kong. And that to them was a very fine base from which they could begin to trade with China, and they claimed Macau as their own, which they have until our own time, all these 100 years. The Spanish were over in the Philippines, and they began to come over towards China and look for places to trade. The Dutch, who you remember, came into Eastern America and founded New York, also went all the way east, and we find them on these islands, the Pescadores Islands, between Japan and China, about the same time. The English, who were among the great explorers at the time, got onto the mainland in Canton, which is here in the south shores of China. And all of them were trying to set up trading stations with China. The Russians came down from the north. They were gradually moving eastward up into Manchuria and Siberia, and wanted to get way out towards the Pacific Ocean. And here you have the beginning of the Russian Empire extending all the way across the North China to the Bering Straits. During that period where modern history is being shaped by what happens. Well, the Chinese didn't want to trade with anyone else. They resisted the merchants, and these barbarians, for these Europeans were barbarians, the Chinese, and they tried to keep them out. They tried to limit the number of days of the year when they could come to Chinese markets and buy things, or sell things, or certain seasons of the year. The Chinese emperors allowed them to set up what they called factories, or really trading posts. What were they trading? Well, the things that these Europeans wanted in China were like tea. Tea became one of the great exports of China. Rhubarb, porcelain, these things that China had, which the rest of the world wanted, the traders were willing to pay silver and gold to get. And you have the beginning of the European and American trade with China. Way back in our own history, there was a term that we've almost forgotten now, except in Yahti, the Chinese clipper. Well, the Chinese clipper was a sailing vessel that sailed to China. And a good many New England fortunes were made by these Chinese expeditions that get things from China and bring them back and sell at exorbitant prices, but they made fortunes. China wasn't able to keep them away, but it tried to limit them. And for the next couple hundred years, China is resisting this invasion from the rest of the world. China wanted to be let alone, except for rulers like the Mongolians who expanded outside of China. China simply was content to have what it did have. We're not talking now about the Chinese people as a whole, because they were mostly peasants who were oppressed by the landlords and the merchants. But the Chinese were content if only the rest of the world would let them alone. But the rest of the world wasn't going to let them alone. And that is the story of the next couple of centuries. The last of the dynasties was the Manchu dynasty, which lasted to 1912. And there were a couple of great emperors in that period. But our own interest is rather in what happened in regard to these relations between China and Europe and America. The Chinese and the traders gradually agreed to certain treaties. And you have, in the 19th century, a whole string of treaties between China and these other nations, opening up China. Reluctant as China was, it didn't have much choice. Why? Because these Europeans had gunships, warships. They had developed military power in a way the Chinese had not. The Chinese had not gone much beyond the older period of a lot of people, which they had in plenty, and armies made up of thousands and tens of thousands, but with rather primitive weapons. So when when England showed up with its gunships and said, "You give us what we want or we'll open fire," what was the Chinese effort to do? They began to give in. And one of the early treaties allowed the outsiders a certain number of ports. To begin with, there were 5 ports that the traders could come to. But this was extended later to 11, and then much beyond that. These ports were on the ocean side here, and were all the way from what is now Hong Kong up here to way up towards Peking. So you have an invasion of the Europeans attacking, really, China from the ocean, while on the north, Russia was pressing down from the land, sort of pincers movement. And for a couple of centuries, China is trying to get out of this squeezing by foreigners of her ports, of her land. Well, the opening of the ports wasn't too bad in its own way, but what happened was that the traders wanted to set their own regulations. You'd think that the Chinese would have a right to set the taxes, the import duties, and look after the trade, but the British and the Dutch, Portuguese weren't satisfied with that. They said, we'll set our own taxes. We'll decide how much we'll pay, or if we pay anything. And even worse than that, if anything happened, who was going to control the element that were in need of police power? And one of the early incidents involved the murder of a Chinese by some of these traders. No one knows exactly who. And when the Chinese said, "We'll try the murderers," the merchant said, "No, we'll take care of that." It's the beginning of what you call extraterritoriality, the territory beyond. That is, the Europeans said, "We want this territory of yours, and our laws will apply here. We'll decide who's to be punished, and we'll take care of these relationships." You can imagine what would happen if some European power got into the state of Washington, or some Washington, I'm on the West Coast, I forget, some Atlantic port, say France set up a little colony on the Atlantic seaboard and said, "This is our territory, you keep out and we'll make the laws and regulations here." Of course, we'd soon put them out. But China couldn't, and the result was this little chain of territories along the East Coast where foreigners dominated. Set the tariff regulations, made the laws, decided what the taxes would be. And of course the Chinese hated this, but they couldn't help it. These became concessions to the foreigners and remained even into modern times. When we read what happened in our own lifetime in China, and China began to have power to react toward others, let us not forget how we acted toward them in those days. The French, the Portuguese, the English, all of them had the sovereign rights of China. And most questionable of all, to me at least, is that this is the way the missionaries got into China. The Chinese didn't want the Christian missionaries. They had their own religion, and they were not anxious to have others come in. There had been missionaries before the 18th century. I mentioned earlier the coming of the Nestorians way back in the 7th and 8th centuries. Nestorian Christians who come in from the southeast, but they hadn't endured very long. But there were Roman Catholic missionaries back in the 13th century. There was a John of Monte Corvino sent by the Pope in 1290. And there were four churches in Peking in the 13th, 14th century. And after the Jesuits, or after the traders came, the Jesuits, and Marco Polo tells us about some of these. And we know that there were some of the Jesuit missionaries that enjoyed a rather good reputation and station at the court. There was a Michael Ruggieri and a Walter Ricci who were used by the emperor as mathematicians and cartographers. And the emperor even used them in the making of guns. But these were rather exceptional. They were few, and they were not too anxious to evangelize the country. They were monks, friars, who wanted, of course, to have followers, but they were willing to modify the Christian customs to suit the Chinese. And there's an interesting chapter here where there was a conflict between these Roman Catholic missionaries and the Pope. These Jesuits, who were very well educated, said, let's adjust our Christian customs to the customs of the Chinese. Let them have their sacrifices. Let them follow their rites as long as we preach the gospel to them and they obey the church. Well, the Chinese emperor said, well, if you don't upset our customs, our family rites, for instance, you go ahead. But the Pope said no. The Pope said you can't adjust our Christian rules of behavior to your Chinese customs, and that put an end to some of these relations between Rome and the Chinese emperor. But in the 19th century, when the missionaries came with the merchants, it's a different story. When one of the treaties that was made between China and France, for instance, France claimed this part of Southeast Asia. You remember how we got into Vietnam? After the Vietnamese had destroyed the French armies, we took over. Well, the French armies were in Vietnam because they'd been there for a long, long time. France claimed these extraterritorial rights and these sovereign circles of influence in that part of the East. And the French had made treaties with China in regard to their relations. And one of the stipulations of the treaty was that you should allow our Roman Catholic missionaries. And so Spanish and French missionaries became the main missionaries of the Roman Catholic Church in China. But they were there as a part of a treaty which had been extorted from the Chinese at the end of a gun. In his one of his thoughts, Little Red Book of Mao, there's a very sentence which has been quoted time and again. Political power is at the end of a gun. And while we think that's true of the Chinese, the communists, it was equally true of the so-called European Christians. the political power at the end of the gun. And the gunboats, the warships, the soldiers of France and England, later Germany,
and the result is what the United States and Palestine resented. And there's the beginning of an anti-European, anti-American, anti-anything foreign influence in China, which historians tell us run right through the 19th century in China. You have one uprising after another, but almost always the Chinese lost. I think one of the saddest of these happenings was the Opium War, which we don't like to talk about very much. Actually, the Chinese emperor had forbidden the use of opium in China for generations. They tried to stamp it out. And what led to the Opium War in China was the insistence of English merchants that they had the right to bring opium from India to China. They could make huge profits on it. And when the Chinese tried to stop it, this same situation I've been describing, where the Chinese were helpless, they were forced to accept the opium importation. The result was that the Chinese began to use opium at a rate never before. It was a profitable enterprise. And the mills of God grind slowly, is an old saying. Is part of our drug problem a delayed punishment for some of the things we've done in the past to other people? Where we make money on drugs, on other people, and then we complain when we begin to use it ourselves. History's full of these tragic things, but they have consequences from which we can't escape. And we don't like to talk about the Opium War and the part that Europeans had in it, but it was one of these treaties that was negotiated that the English should have the right to bring in opium, which they did. I can't go into many of these various relationships. The question of the jurisdiction and the killing of Chinese I've already touched on, which led the Britons to send an expeditionary force in 1840-42, and they made the Chinese pay very great indemnities, and also got the Chinese to give them Hong Kong. You go to Hong Kong today, you think it's wonderful, it's a serious place. Doesn't belong to China, the center of trade. Well, Hong Kong belongs to China. And the English took it away from it and made it a great center of the Imperial British dominion. Then a little later, it got the 99-year lease on Kowloon, which is just outside of Hong Kong, sort of a gateway into China. That lease will expire in a few years. It'll be interesting to see if England's going to be able to maintain it. My guess is that China will reclaim it. But the French got a 99-year concession on a fort in their part of the country. The Germans, who weren't to be left out after the German Empire started, middle of the century, that took a whole peninsula up here and said, we'll take care of this. This will be our near the building. And they built railroads into the interior. The Russians came down here from the north and took another peninsula up here, Vladivostok and Port Arthur, led to war finally. But I have to summarize what is happening. In these two centuries after, or the middle of the 17th to the end of the 19th, was that China was being carved up by the great powers. Everyone wanted to have a part in the pie. The Portuguese, the Spanish, the Dutch, the English, the Germans, the Russians, even the Scandinavians got here somewhere, but not very much. But unless you had some port of entry to China, some place you could call your trading relationship, you weren't quite modern. The United States, which has always wanted to seem a little more circumspect in its dealings, said we don't want to go in and take our part. The door policy. Our policy is that everybody should have the same rights, including ourselves, of course. But since we got in there too and had the same rights, we were willing to let other people have it. One can become cynical, I know, pessimistic about the political things of this kind, and it makes it very difficult to pass some Christian judgments on them, but this is the kind of the world it is. It's the kind of relationships that exist between nations, and nations want something, they're going to have it. And the nation that says it's the strongest, it claims that it can get it. About 1900, well, there were two or three rebellions of Chinese against this. One of the most interesting was the rebellion that is known as the It was a rebellion of the Chinese who had mixed up some of the Christianity they heard with their own relationship to the outside world. And started to, the leader of it called himself a younger brother of Christ. They heard something of the Chinese, of the Christian gospel, and they identified their own needs with the resistance to injustice. And the leader had gotten a group of people around him who were sort of confused Christianity with their own political needs. They were crushed, of course, very soon. The more consequential rebellion was the Boxer Rebellion, about 1900. The Boxers are called, but the rebellion is called Boxers because it consists, it was led by groups of gymnasts who box, and the name stuck to them. They had certain training rules in which boxing helped them to prepare for military adventure. But they too, of course, were crushed by both the Manchu Emperor and the outsiders who saw in this rebellion a threat to their own places of favor. The Boxer Rebellion was also an anti-missionary movement because the missionaries represented foreigners, and some of the attitude towards missionaries in China was a result of the anti-foreign feeling. The reason I mention the Boxer Rebellion is that the great powers forced the Chinese to pay indemnity, but the United States, and this is certainly to its credit, instead of taking this money used for scholarships, to bring a lot of the Chinese students to here to study. And that brings us to a period where the Chinese young people begin to come in contact with the Western world, and we come into the modern period. Well, tomorrow I'll go on with the story of Sun Yat-sen, who was one of these students who had learned something about democracy in the outside world, and became a revolutionary and led to the breakup of the Manchu dynasty. And Chiang Kai-shek, between them, you can tell the story of what happened in China, say from about 1900 to 1937, first 30th century. And in that period, that communism begins to take root, and Mao comes into the picture. And I've taken this time to get the background, because to me it's useless to speak about Chinese communism unless you know the kind of a country in which it grew up, the kind of a condition that led to the break with the past. And no judgment of Mao, Zhou Enlai, communism, I think has any validity that doesn't see it in its relationship to the past history of the China. Well, we'll stop here and go on tomorrow. And as we go on, I'm going to allow more time for discussion as we get more problems as we go along. Thank you.